Hello, this is Brian Scuttle. I'm an independent filmmaker, film critic, and composer in Atlanta, Georgia. And I'm here to discuss not only 2001 A Space Odyssey, the Stanley Kubrick film, but also a project that I did that was inspired by it. The album is Beyond the Infinite, and it's something that I devised as sort of an alternative soundtrack to 2001. Not that I think that the soundtrack right now that the film has had for 42 years is lacking, but just that I felt that because of the fact that Kubrick used existing classical music as well as opposed to an traditional film score, I felt like there was an opportunity there for me to, in a way, put my own stamp on the film and to let my creative juices flow, in a matter of speaking, and see where they took me musically. The first few pieces you heard were the overture, which was performed by strings, the Planets Align, which is a brass quintet that is the first performance of the fanfare that I did in lieu of also Sprach Zarathustra by Strauss. And the last piece that you heard was Dawn of Man, which was actually the first piece I composed for this project. Composed that back in 2000, and it's for flute, cello, and marimba. And that was just the introduction to Dawn of Man. The longer version, or it's a longer version of the piece that I ended up writing. Unfortunately, that's not currently recorded and couldn't be on the album. It's a bit too complicated for me to do through MIDI, which is how I record the first three pieces. But one day I do hope to get recorded by actual live musicians, and at that point, hopefully it'll be available for release. Anyway, what I'm trying to do as far as this commentary is to not only give you a sense of what inspired me to do Beyond the Infinite and to talk about that process, but also to give you some of my own thoughts about the film in general. The film itself is widely considered one of the greatest films ever made. Rightfully so, I feel. It's certainly one of the best films I've ever seen, and it's my favorite Kubrick film, as I'm sure it is for other people. Part of the reason for that is obvious. I mean, apart from the film's visual beauty and visual imagination, is also the use of sound, and not just music, but the use of sound effects, and how sparsely Kubrick uses dialogue in the film. It's one of the key aspects of the storytelling process in this film, and it's one of the things that's really drawn me into the film again and again over the years. And it's something that I do think still inspires filmmakers to this day, thinking about some of the films of Christopher Nolan, like The Dark Knight and Inception, which I actually saw earlier this week. There's a lot of similarities in terms of what Nolan does with that film in terms of sound, using sound as far as using visual effects to tell the story, that I think harken back to what Kubrick did in 2001. And one of the things that I've always found pretty remarkable about 2001 is the way he uses sound effects to tell the story more than dialogue. I think that's one of the important aspects of it, and I think it's one of the great things about the film is it's also the fact that he doesn't use sound effects just for to tell to get together an entire like wall of sound. But I'll talk to you more about that later. Okay, that piece was A Frightening Awakening, and it was performed by a friend of mine, Don Eccles, who has been playing piano for me for several years. And what I wanted to do with that piece is, obviously, you heard the more structured part on the bottom, as well as trills on the top. The piece was actually written that way, and, well, I'll talk more about that later.
Thank you.
Okay, that was The Dawn of Intelligence, also played by my friend Don Eccles. And before we get to that, going back to the trills so I can finish that thought up, as I was going to say before, the piece was structured to had obviously had the more structured piece on the bottom with trills on the top, and that's how it was written. What we ended up doing, like 4 or 5 passes with the trills, partially because of the fact that Dawn is not a professional pianist, so her trilling wasn't quite as what it used to be when she played regularly. But basically what I ended up doing was I ended up using all of the different takes that we did and of the trills and sort of layering them all on top. So you have like, so in addition to the structured part, you have 2 or 3 series of trills sometimes going on at once. And so that was actually kind of a nice thing to add to that, especially since the piece that Kubrick used, Requiem by Ligeti, has that sort of very dissonant feel, but at the same time feels very structured. And I mean, there's always a structure to it, even if you can't necessarily tell, and it's very experimental otherwise. Going back to The Dawn of Intelligence, that was an instance where, if you notice in the performance, it actually sounds, it doesn't quite sound as grand as it did when the brass quintet played it. That is the second performance of the fanfare for Beyond the Infinite. And it doesn't sound as grand because of the fact that Dawn was actually playing a D flat as opposed to D natural in some of the cases. But the fact of the matter is, that performance, the reason that performance was used is because of the fact that I just liked that performance and I liked that take more than I did the other ones. So it really fit well. So that's why when you hear the fanfare the second time, it's more minor than major.
Thank you.
here we are into space after the flash, after the jump cut from the bone floating in the air to the spaceship. And that was Weightless Waltz and F, and it was one of the first pieces I wrote for Beyond the Infinite after Dawn of Man. It was actually written in 2006, which I'll get more into the history of the album and how long it took a little bit later. But one of the things that I wanted to do in Beyond the Infinite, and one of the things that I do think was, in a way, sort of a missed opportunity in 2001 in the first place, was to bring in electronic music. And at the time, electronic music was just coming into its own, and Walter / Wendy Carlos had just done Switched on Bach recently, and she would later go on to score Clockwork Orange and write a couple of cues for The Shining as well, for Kubrick. And but one of the things that I wanted to do was bring in electronic sound. I wanted to, and one of the things that I wanted to do in Beyond the Infinite, which I think you've already noticed, is I wanted to combine regular sort of classical, more chamber music with electronic music, and that afforded a lot of opportunities. Like, for instance, having a waltz-like piece performed by electronic sounds. It's something that I really became enamored with the idea, and I'm really quite pleased with the way Weightless Waltz and F turned out. It's one of my favorite pieces that I've done. And but one of the things you've no doubt heard already in the music is the fact that I'm using different orchestrations of different musical ideas. And it's something that Kubrick didn't really do in 2001, as far as, you know, it's something that's obviously a little bit more easier when you commission an original score to have the composer do that. But when you're using existing classical music like Kubrick was, it's obviously not as easy. Not to say that I feel like Kubrick was wrong in his choices. He was completely right, and the music is a big part of the reason I keep coming back to the film, because of the way he uses it. But one of the things that I wanted to do was I wanted to sort of go to the idea of, use the idea of themes and themes for specific events, and sort of see what those themes sound like in different orchestrations. So in the Fanfare, you heard it first as a brass quintet. It's big, it's bold, and it's a good way to introduce the album, as you see in the opening credits. In the second performance of the Fanfare, during the Dawn of Intelligence, and when the monkey is using the bone for the first time as a weapon and figuring that out, you hear it in piano. And for me, the piano is more organic. It's more down to earth in a way, in the sense that, you know, I mean, man at the time, and I mean, they, man at the time is, or intelligent life at the time is very much down to earth, very much to the ground, and obviously hasn't evolved into what it is now, which we're seeing on screen, which is a species that's able to explore the stars. And so that's part of the reason I use piano for the two pieces you hear, the other two pieces you hear during the Dawn of Man. Plus, it's actually a very interesting progression from marimba to the piano. They're both sort of percussive. They're both sort of rhythmic in a way. And that's another thing that sort of interested me about doing that. And you'll hear the theme once, the fanfare once more in the later in the album, which is during the Star Child sequence, when it is performed by electronic sounds. And that's probably my favorite instrumentation of that in general, just because of the fact that it's so out of the ordinary as far as what you would expect to hear when you listen to a piece like that. And it's one of the things that really intrigued me most about doing Beyond the Infinite, which is the idea of doing things a bit differently than people might be used to, which, you know, I mean, obviously the Blue Danube, which scores the space, the first couple of space travel sequences, is, you know, a very classical piece of music, traditional instrumentation and stuff like that. Well, what would a piece like that sound like with electronic sounds? And that's one of the things that interested me most. And I think that turned out really well. I'm really pleased about that. And that's sort of one of the other things where I wanted to start out the album using, you know, traditional, or, you know, at least traditional instruments, what everybody's used to, strings, brass, woodwinds, and percussion, and stuff like that, during the scenes on Earth and the opening titles and the overture and what have you. But later on, once it gets into space, because of the fact that it's more futuristic, and it's still more futuristic, I mean, this type of space travel just is not possible yet. And even though we're 9 years after 2001, so it still is futuristic now and still in a way otherworldly. So to bring electronic music into that, which I think is capable of more otherworldly and evocative moods than regular music, not that you can't evoke mood well in chamber music, because you can, but it seemed like something that would fit Kubrick's intentions in this film very well. And the piece coming up is the second waltz. It's called Weightless Waltz in D.
Thank you.
So that was Weightless Waltz in D, and it was also written in 2006, shortly after Weightless Waltz in F. I'd had the idea for Beyond the Infinite back in 2000. I had written a short 3.5-minute piece in 1999 called Beyond the Infinite that was inspired by the use of Ligeti and just the visuals in the, especially in the last part of 2001, where David Bowman has entered Jupiter's airspace and space and goes on the light show of a lifetime. And it was a little piece. It was 3.5 minutes, but it basically provided some of the musical ideas as well as the inspiration of doing Beyond the Infinite and sort of treating it like a film score. And part of the way that I did that was I watched the film, and I've watched the film a couple of dozen times, but I watched the film and wrote down and jotted down the times that the music starts in the piece, in the film, and when it ends, so that I could basically start with those basic running times as indicators of how long the pieces are going to be, and basically wrote the pieces based on that. I figured out how the tempo that I wanted to use, and from that I figured out the measure lengths, and for the most part fit really well. If you noticed earlier, A Frightening Awakening is a bit longer than the music goes on in that sequence, but that's all right. It's, you know, it's about 10-12 seconds difference, but it still, I think, captures the mood of what's supposed to be happening there without necessarily insisting on it, which is part of the great things that Kubrick used in the way he uses music in this film. And also the Dawn of the Intelligence is a bit shorter than the other exclamations of the fanfare that you heard with the Planets Align and that you'll hear later. And you know, again, it's only about 4 or 5 seconds, so really the difference in length is sort of negligible and not really something that bothers me that much. It's just worth mentioning. One of the great things about what Kubrick does in this film with music, and part of the great thing they achieves by using classical music as opposed to an original score, is the fact that the film, he uses the music to score the film, but there's a distance away from the film. Even though the music is going with what we see on screen, it's not necessarily giving us emotional cues as to how to feel about what's going on screen. It's just sort of wallpaper music, something you would put on in the background doing chores or something like that. And I think that's one of the best things that we get out of the use of classical music in this film. the opening to A Mysterious Lunar Discovery, which is the next piece on our program. And one of the things that really inspired me to get really passionate and really down to the nitty gritty as far as finally working on Beyond the Infinite was the inclusion of some new equipment to my home studio. I had just been working with a Yamaha keyboard, which has some really lovely synth sounds and some pretty decent classical instrument sounds. But, you know, in the end, it's one of those things where I just started using a lot of the same sounds over and over, and that's not necessarily always a good thing. And, I mean, you know, there's a reason that I use some of the same sounds over and over, but the fact of the matter is I did want a little bit of variety. Well, in 2008, I was able to add some new equipment to my studio in the form of a little 8-bus mixer, some new speakers to go with my computer, as well as the Microkorg synthesizer / vocoder. And the sounds that you heard in Mysterious Lunar Discovery are sounds that emitted, that came from the Microkorg. And it really gets a workout in this portion of the album. And as you'll hear as we continue on with A Mysterious Lunar Discovery. Thank you. So that was the first part of the next piece, The Minutia of Space, which dovetailed from the end of Mysterious Lunar Discovery. Now, the vocoder parts on Mysterious Lunar Discovery, the music that I recorded is similar to the music from A Frightening Awakening. Obviously, the vocoder makes it a little bit more pretty difficult to notice than the denser sound of the electronic sounds is difficult. It's difficult to figure out structure in the music itself, but it is similar. And it's one of the things that I sort of want to try to do in my music in much the same way that Kubrick uses pieces in 2001 to sort of signify and sort of as sort of themes and motifs for different characters, for different actions, and for different situations. Like the way he uses the Blue Danube for the space travel, the way he uses also Sprach Zarathustra for the almost the moments of great realization, at least on the part of the audience, and the moments of great accomplishment, whether it's the planets aligning, whether it's man using his first tool in the form of the bone, and also at the end when he becomes a star child, which is the next evolution of human development, according to the film. That's something that I really was intrigued by, and I haven't yet mentioned the Alex North score that was partially composed, but not used for the film, but I've listened to dozens of times, and along with the music for 2001, it's one of my favorite soundtracks of all time. It's really a beautiful album, and anybody who hasn't listened to it and is a fan of film music, I really recommend it, especially if you love 2001 as much as I do. It's really compelling to listen, and one of the things I wanted to do with Beyond the Infinite was to combine the more experimental aspects of the music that Kubrick used with the tonal continuity of Alex North's score. And for the most part, I think I succeeded in that. And, I mean, obviously in some of the more avant-garde ones, I, sort of go away from tonality and go more towards the mood that specific, sounds and specific ideas, brings out. The vocoder, going back to Mysterious Lunar Discovery for a bit, was really kind of a challenge for me. It's the first time I've ever really used one, at least. And, I mean, I'm sure there are more complicated ones out there than the Microkorg, but it was really a fun instrument to use. As several different settings, some of which where you just basically hold down notes on a keyboard without vocalizing into the microphone, and vocoder-like sounds will come out. And I use some of those in Mysterious Lunar Discovery and later on in the album. But also doing the vocalizations in general. And I'm not a singer by experience, but you know, it was a very different experience. It was a lot like playing a regular musical instrument, and I was a trombonist for several years. But basically the way it works is as you vocalize into a microphone, you hold down the notes on the keyboard, and the sound emits from there. And it's really interesting because of the fact that whatever note you're holding down, that's what will come out as opposed to what you might actually be singing. So that was the second half of the Minutia of Space, and that piece has actually grown on me to be one of my favorite pieces on the album. When I first performed it electronically, it's a very simple piece. It's just three electronic voices spread out. There's a lot of silences, a lot of space between some of the notes, as you can hear in the piece. And admittedly, I liked it, but it wasn't exactly one of my personal favorites. But listening to it more in context of the album as a whole, I've really become attached to it and really come to appreciate more what I've what I was able to do with that. And so that's something that I really appreciate about the album. And it's interesting because of the fact that there are other instances, especially with my previous album, Sonic Visions of a New Old West, where the album as a whole was really really was able to elevate certain pieces above what I thought they were individually, and this is another instance of that. So now we're pretty much settled in on Discovery One in 2001, and one of the things that I really like about this portion of the film in particular is the fact that Kubrick really, in developing the character of Hal and his interactions with Dave and Frank, really injects a lot of sort of dark humor into their interactions, especially when it looks like Hal has made the mistake as far as the equipment failing. It just listening to his interaction, his rationality compared to Dave and Frank's skepticism really allows for some very dark pieces of humor. And it's something that sort of that grew on me in Dr. Strangelove, but is something that I've really come to appreciate about this film as well as Dr. Strangelove, which actually, first time I saw it with my grandfather, and I just sat there at the end of the movie, and when this is supposed to be a comedy, I just didn't get it, and I didn't appreciate what Kubrick did. I've seen it since several more times, and it really is one of the best films he ever did, short of 2001. Like I said before, I've seen 2001 several times, and but probably my best experience watching it was in 2002 when I finally got to see it on the big screen. The Fox Theater is part of their movie film festival, summer movie film festival, showed it in 70 millimeter. And if you've ever seen a movie at the Fox, it's in Atlanta, it's absolutely fantastic. It's absolutely beautiful. It's one of the best movie-going experiences you can ever have there, and you can ever have in this city. And it was like watching the film for the first time. It might have actually been the first time I had seen it in widescreen, which I can't remember that I ever did on video or DVD before. But it was just amazing. It felt like there were details and there were elements that I had never really noticed before that I noticed for the first time in that screening. And it's still one of my favorite experiences watching a movie of all time, is watching that. And it's one of the many times I've actually been very fortunate to see a classic movie on the big screen. I've watched re-releases of Touch of Evil. I've seen Citizen Kane on the big screen. I've seen The Maltese Falcon a couple of times on the big screen. Bonnie and Clyde, Dial M for Murder. The Star Wars movies, obviously, but I mean, that was more, I mean, I was young when I was watching those. And you know, it's just been, I've been very, blessed as a moviegoer to be able to say that I've seen several of these movies on the big screen. And 2001 certainly one of the best experiences I've had in doing that. back in 2008, which is, as I mentioned before, I believe, when I really sort of properly began the process of writing Beyond the Infinite and recording it and getting it prepared for release, I'd started work on it around about a month before my birthday. So the thing that I did to sort of celebrate my birthday that year was I held a screening of 2001: A Space Odyssey at my friend Ryan's house. And in addition to screening the movie itself, I also had put the film on my computer, and I took the visuals from the film and edited and sort of put my pieces with the intended sequences in the movie that they were supposed to be for. So some of these, like the Weightless Waltzes, Mysterious Lunar Discovery, and another piece, which is coming up later, Anthrakt, which basically scores the intermission here, as sort of replaces Ligeti's Atmospheres. So I was able to show people basically how some of these pieces were working in context of the movie itself, and it really got a good response, not only musically, but also in the way I was able to present those. And it was really, it's really, this is actually the first time I'm listening to some of these pieces with the film. My new show Space was like that, and all of the film, all of the pieces during the Dawn of Man sequence and during the openings, as well as the piece that plays during the light show at the end. So that was an interesting experience, and it's been really great to see what the music, how the music interacts with the movie. And I think I did a really, and if I do say so myself, I really think I accomplished what I wanted to accomplish with this in terms of designing it as a as an alternative soundtrack to 2001. Of course, I wouldn't trade the soundtrack that Kubrick put on the film for anything, though. One of the things that I've really come to appreciate, and one of the reasons that I really love 2001, is apart from its use of music, also the use of sound effects to help tell the story. And it's one of the most imaginative uses of sound effects. I was going to talk earlier about the fact that instead of doing this big wall of sound, which most filmmakers would do while making a movie like this, you would have, like here you might have real dramatic music and you would have sound more in space, which, I mean, there is no sound in space, and this is one of the few movies that's really followed that religiously. You have sound effects that, because of how sparse sound is throughout the film, really enhance the storytelling and really are more powerful as a result of being so sparse. And in particular, in later sequences, you really get an idea of that better than you do here. Although, this is certainly a wonderful sequence to see an example of that. there's not really a whole lot that one to touch on the film itself, music, other than the music. I mean, obviously the film is a technical achievement that really even now has still not really been matched, in the way it creates realistic special effects as well that really stand the test of time, even as visual effects have gotten more and more elaborate and more impressive over the years. This is still probably, these are still some of the greatest visual effects I've ever seen in a film. And just because of the fact that they don't always call attention to themselves as well as they help tell the story. And that's something that you don't often see much nowadays. Right now, I mean, usually you just see special effects for the sake of having big, expensive visual effects. There are a few films that have really accomplished that. I think one that I saw earlier this week was Chris Nolan's Inception, which I think was able to use special effects in the same way that Kubrick used them here, in terms of more as storytelling devices than just for their own sake. The special effects used in Dark City by Alex Proyas is another great example. And especially in Proyas' films in particular, with the possible exception of I, Robot, is that's certainly been the case as far as the way he's used visual effects, and it's really impressive to see for somebody who used to be a music video director. That's not always something that you get an idea for. David Fincher is another example of a music video director who's really come into his own as a storyteller and using visual effects to help tell the story. The more you watch this film, or at least the more I've watched this film, the less you really miss, the less you really notice just how little dialogue and how little how much silence is in the movie. The movie just continues to draw me in every time I've seen it. And you know, while I wouldn't necessarily say I see things, different things in every screening of it, but the fact of the matter is there are always moments that, the same moments that entertain me the second or third time I saw it, continue to entertain me now. And I think that's one of the great things about Kubrick's films, is that he doesn't insist on your enjoyment of the film as entertainment, and he's not afraid to afraid to challenge our preconceived notions of what cinema's capable of. I mean, he does this in all of the films that I've seen of his, going all the way back to Paths of Glory, all the way up to Eyes Wide Shut, which I still think is a very underrated film, and actually one of, still, I think, one of the best films he's ever done. This is an example here of this sequence really showing some of the dark humor that Kubrick was able to put in this. It's very dry, but at the same time, just the way that Hal interacts with Dave and Frank when, and his confidence in himself, and the fact that it's not his fault, it's, you know, just in accountable to human error, that the discrepancy that's going on, just the interactions between the characters is really entertaining and very, very dark and very funny as well. It's something that you don't really notice the first time you watch it, or if you do notice it, you don't necessarily consciously notice it, even though you find yourself laughing at these interactions. But it's really a testament to Kubrick's genius as a filmmaker here that this is something that can be picked up on and not necessarily noticed on a conscious level during the film. That'd be funny if Frank had said it loud enough to where Hal actually did it, but that would have been a little too cartoony, I think, for Kubrick. You know, it's funny. I saw this. When I first saw it, it was in like 1998, and when I first started watching it, Gary Lockwood, who plays Frank Poole, the only other thing I'd seen him in was The Magic Sword, which I watched on Mystery Science Theater 3000, and the first time I realized that was him in this movie, I was very, very surprised by it, and it's really kind of, you know, it makes me kind of interested in seeing some of the other movies he's been in, to see him in such a wide disparity of movies, to see him in something like this, which is great, to something like The Magic Sword, which is entertaining, even, which I would imagine would still be pretty entertaining without the Mystery Science Theater track. But at the same time, is also very cheesy as well, and that would be pretty interesting to see some of the other films that he's done. Again, one of the great things that Kubrick does here is, and that's been much commented on, is the fact that he implies and he shows us that Hal is reading their lips without necessarily hitting us over the head with it. And it's another one of the things that makes him such an effective filmmaker.